Keepers of the Garden by Dolores Cannon. First printing, 1993 printing, Origin of Life of Earth revealed through past life hypnotic regression. Includes descriptions of life on other planet and in other dimensions. 1. Extraterrestrials 2. UFOs 3. Hypnosis 4. Reincarnation 5. Past Life Therapy I. Cannon. The discovery of star-child extraterrestrials are living now on Earth. They can no longer be considered as aliens existing only on distant stars or cruising around in spaceships. They are everywhere, among your friends, our neighbors, even your relatives. We are all interrelated, for they are our ancestors. Their blood flows through our very veins. We are as much a brother to the beings from the stars as we are to the animals of the Earth. This was revealed to me through a year's intensive work with an actual star person. Our contact was made through hypnosis. I am a regressionist and I regularly take trips through time and space to visit Earth's past and learn about history as it is being lived. But until my work with Phil D. began, I had never visited other planets. I had always wished to. I thought it surely would not be any more improbable than what I was already doing. Surely some human being had experienced life somewhere else besides Earth. The idea fascinated me. But so far the proper subject had never crossed my path. I thought this type of person would be rare. But as I work with so many people, I assumed that the odds were that sooner or later I would find one, or they would find me, which is usually more accurate. I had no way of knowing that the odds were greater than I thought. But these people are not easily recognized. They are very cleverly disguised, even from themselves, by the protective subconscious. When I started on this totally unexpected journey, I was preconditioned, as we all are, to think of anything alien as being frightening and bad. Anything we can't understand, we naturally fear. I was quite surprised to find a totally different picture of these creatures than has been presented by the movies and TV and science fiction stories. It, too, the keepers of the garden, took quite a while to overcome the brainwashing of several years and to think that deep within us, our spiritual side, there is no difference, only misunderstanding. My work with Phil began quite by accident. If anything can ever truly be called an accident, I take appointments from many different types of people who want the experience of hypnotic regression into past lives. There is really no true type of person that this method works best on. My subjects are truly a broad cross-section of humanity. They all have their own reasons for wanting to explore the possibility of reincarnation. I often go to their houses for the sessions because people are more comfortable in a familiar environment and they do not feel quite so threatened by the whole idea. I have conducted hypnotic regressions in almost every conceivable setting, from the grandest to the simplest type of residence, in motel rooms and even businesses and stores after hours. I have had to learn to become adaptable and feel at ease even under awkward circumstances, because I believe that the comfort of the subject is the most important ingredient in developing trust. My work in this unusual field had taken me to some strange locations and I finally had to draw the line. I was traveling so far afield that it was taking me longer to drive than to do the work. So I set a limit. I would travel no farther than about 50 miles. Anyone who lived farther away would have to make arrangements to meet me at a friend's house. I was afraid to turn anyone down because that one person might be the one I was looking to work with. The one that would be able to supply information needed to start off on another exciting journey. There is no exterior way to tell, and I never know what I am looking for until I find it. These are normal, everyday people with no outward clues to the adventures their souls have experienced in other lives and times. I had an appointment with a young divorced businesswoman and I had driven almost to my limit, 50 miles, to have a session with her in her home. Twice before she had set up an appointment but had cancelled out at the last minute. I often suspected she was not yet ready for regression. It can frequently be too revealing. Maybe she was subconsciously afraid of what she would find if she began to probe into her hidden past, and these excuses were her way out. I did not rush it. I had far too many others to work with. As I drove into the small town, I thought she was finally going to go through with it this time because she had not called to tell me otherwise. But when I turned into her street and neared her house, I didn't. The discovery of Starch Alt 3, see her car. Instead, in the driveway was an unfamiliar yellow truck with the advertising of a local electronics repair shop emblazoned on its side. My first thought was that she had forgotten our appointment and was having work done on her TV. It would have been typical of her, and I knew I could not conduct a hypnotic session in such an atmosphere. As I got out of my car, I noticed a note on her door. She had been called away on business, but she had arranged a replacement so I wouldn't have made the long trip for nothing. The note said that my subject, Phil D., was waiting inside. It was her nature to do something like this at the last minute, so I was not totally surprised. Thus my subject will be a total stranger, not an ideal arrangement. I did not expect a lot from the session. New subjects can often be difficult to work with, especially if they have no former knowledge of hypnosis. His guard would probably be up, and I supposed most of the session would be spent establishing trust and rapport, which is so important in a working relationship of this type. I fully expected that this would be a one-time experience and I would probably never see Phil again. Phil turned out to be a nice-looking dark-haired young man, 28 years of age, quiet and I suspected rather shy. I found later that this was merely a quiet self-assuredness. He had his own electronics repair business, which he operated out of his parents' garage. He was from a large family, one of five children, and lived at home. About the only thing unusual about him was that he was an identical twin. In the course of time, I found out much about Phil. He seemingly had little interest in girls and had never had a serious relationship, which was surprising because he was quite attractive. He had spent some time in the Navy, where he had learned electronics. One of the first things people ask me about an excellent subject is what their religious beliefs are. Somehow they assume that in order to display these abilities, the person must have had an unorthodox religious upbringing. This is far from the truth. Every religious belief is represented. It seems to have little influence on the type of information I receive. Phil was raised in a strict Catholic environment and served as an altar boy in the local church, participating in masses, funerals and holiday observances. He attended a Catholic school under the instruction of nuns until the seventh grade, so he was well indoctrinated with the catechism. This was hardly the atmosphere to encourage thoughts of reincarnation. He had an interest in the occult, had done much reading, and wanted to try regression out of curiosity. He was very, 4_ the keepers of the garden, amiable and seemed at ease with me and the idea of hypnosis from the beginning. The first session turned out as I suspected it would. Although he went easily into a medium level of trance, he was not communicative. His voice was mumbling and his grunting answers made it very difficult to tell whether he was answering yes or no. This is a common problem and often happens when the subject is so relaxed. Their answers come slowly, as though they are lazily talking in their sleep. They become very absorbed in what they are seeing but will volunteer no information unless directed to do so. I do not like to work this hard anymore. I prefer a freer flow of communication, and this is one reason why I search for somnambulists, wandering around in the desert. At one time he was searching for water, and later when he awakened he said he could really feel the thirst, the hot, dry climate and the combined misery of those around him. This was quite typical of a first regression. It is very common to relive a simple, ordinary life as the subconscious explores this new experience. Upon awakening, he said that the impressions he received were quite vivid, but he was so relaxed that it was a real effort to try to talk to me. He said he now knew what it was like to be old, because he really felt that way toward the end of the man's life, old and tired and dragged out. He was exhilarated by the experience and eagerly wanted to try it again. I wish I could say that I was enthusiastic also, but at the time I was not excited about working with him again. It was too difficult to get answers from him. I prefer to work with people who are more spontaneous and talkative. But if someone wants to do this type of work, I generally agree. I don't like to refuse anyone because I have no way of knowing what insight the individual may be getting out of the session. So I reluctantly set up an appointment for the next week. I assumed that after a few sessions his curiosity would be satisfied and I could resume looking for more productive subjects. In my technique I use many different procedures and I try various ones until the subject finds one they are the most comfortable with. One method utilizes an elevator. When the subject feels they have arrived at the correct floor and the elevator door opens, they feel a desire to get off and explore whatever they see. This method was tried during the second session and proved to be Phil's favorite. We are still using it and it has turned into a very valuable tool in contact. Phil relived the boring and uneventful life of a man. The discovery of Starchild, 5, in the various places and levels that we have visited. During the second session he was a little more talkative. He told of a lifetime in Munich during wartime Germany. He and others were Jews employed by a civilian sector of the government. Although their families had been murdered, they were allowed to live because they possessed skills that could be utilized. They had to wear identifying armbands, which he considered insulting. He was a draftsman named Karl Brecht. He and the others were involved in some secret work concerning the designing of submarine bases, but because it was restricted information he was reluctant to talk about it. Even though these Jews were useful to the German cause, they were humiliated and treated badly by their superiors. This made him feel bitter. He spoke of seeing Hitler once in a parade and thought the man was insane. Phil's alter ego, Karl, died when he and another man were flying in a small plane near the French border. They were en route to the site of the submarine base and were mistakenly shot down by enemy anti-aircraft fire. They crashed in the middle of a small village. Upon awakening, he said this session had meaning for him. He had had a very vivid dream that was quite similar to the death scene. The dream had made a strong and lasting impression on him. He had thought he was in the German military and was shot down in a fighter plane because he had seen swastikas on it, but now he realized it was a civilian plane. What had bothered him the most in the dream was the total apathy of the people in the town where the plane crashed. They just stood around and watched him die. Apparently the people were glad the plane had been shot down. They didn't seem moved by what was happening and did not try to help at all. Their animosity made him angry, but he said he felt more emotion in the dream than while watching it under hypnosis. During this session his answers were still slow and difficult to hear at times, but it was improving. He was now becoming comfortable with me. The third session concerned mainly the reliving of our life as a woman in an ancient culture that centered around a huge pyramid and seemed to be located somewhere in South America. A lot of information came through involving the priests and the worship conducted at the time. He told of an interesting ceremony that occurred when the queen died. Her women assistants were given drugs and then stabbed through the heart. This was considered to be an honor as they were all buried together so they could follow her into the afterlife. During this regression Phil relived the experience, 6, the keepers of the garden, of having a baby. It was a strange phenomenon to watch as a man went through all the emotions that a woman experiences during childbirth. She, died when a group of Spanish soldiers invaded the village and began murdering the people. These are the types of lives that people usually relive in the beginning. I am so familiar with them that I no longer find them unusual unless they offer some type of information that could be important. I have collected hundreds of these, and although they may be useful to the subject in some way, they are only useful to me as an accumulative overview of history. However, something strange happened at the beginning of this third session. When the elevator doors first opened, he saw an unfamiliar silhouette on the horizon. The silhouette of a jagged, rugged terrain against a red sky. When he saw it, for some reason it made him feel uncomfortable. It bothered him and he rebelled from it. He didn't want to explore it and asked to get back on the elevator and go somewhere else. I never ask anyone to do anything they feel uneasy about, so I let him go where he wanted to. This was when he wound up standing at the base of the pyramid. This is part of the building of trust when I allow the subject to do what they feel the most comfortable about. It shows them that they really are in control during the regression. I feel that if there is something of importance there for them to see, they will eventually do so if they are not forced. I was curious about the scene because the strange landscape didn't sound like any place I was familiar with. Upon awakening, I asked him why he didn't want to explore it. He said he had no idea where it was either. There was a strangeness about the landscape that he didn't understand. The horizon was not smooth like trees, just a jaggedness that disturbed him. On the right he had seen a spire or something similar with a circular aspect to it. The only way he could describe it was that it looked something like a large donut encircling a monolith near the top. See drawing. There was something about the scene that was uncomfortable, he said softly with a faraway look in his eyes. A twilight feeling, a darkness about it. A darkness that didn't seem to change. His gaze shifted back to the present. I'm very glad that you didn't force me to explore it, that you gave me the option of returning to the elevator. I don't know why, but I felt safer there. There was something unearthly about the scene. Where was it and why did it disturb him? Evidently his subconscious was allowing the discovery of Starchild, 7, I, R15, I1, I, 2 apostrophe I, 1 inch, semicolon Ryandville, EEI, 11 liters slash F1 LLTII, 8, the keepers of the garden, the first rumbling of flashes from another world to seep through. It would be several weeks before we could discover the meaning of this scene and the reason for his reluctance to explore it. In subsequent sessions he seemed to be drawn to the German life even though there were feelings of bitterness there. He felt a great deal of emotion stirred by these memories. There were vivid feelings of anger, frustration and unhappiness. He wanted to let these out very badly while in trance but he was afraid of offending me if he showed emotion. He admitted he had great difficulty dealing with emotion in his present life also. He felt compelled to keep it inside. He would not even allow his family to see his feelings. I assured him that that was what I was there for, so he could safely let it out. This release can oftentimes be very beneficial. During the sessions that followed, he occasionally saw more scenes that bothered him. Glimpses of a strange city with lots of towers and cars that flew like planes and hovered in the air. The whole appearance of the city was of a colorless, gray sameness with white lights showing through. Each time this scene appeared he withdrew from it. He would ask to return again to the safety of the elevator and go elsewhere. I was intrigued because the scenes definitely sounded otherworldly or at least futuristic and I was anxious to explore them. But I knew from experience not to let my curiosity intervene. It was best not to rush the subject, to let them discover these abilities and lives at their own pace. In my work, patience usually pays off. Phil was puzzled. I have the feeling there is something just beneath the surface that is trying to come through and it almost did a couple of times. He felt whatever it was could be contacted through the elevator if he could only find the right floor or level and had the courage to explore it. I sensed it was somehow associated with the various scenes of the jagged horizon and the strange city. We were building trust and rapport and I continued to have sessions with Phil in addition to the others I was working with. His answers were becoming more spontaneous and because of these odd scenes I thought something might possibly emerge that would be worth exploring. They had certainly aroused my curiosity. Little did I know what adventures lay in wait for us. Chapter 2. The Lost Colony. Phil came across the same scene again when the elevator doors opened. He saw the jagged, desolate and somehow forbidding silhouette against a red sky. Apparently his subconscious thought it was time for him to face that life and it kept allowing glimpses of it to sneak into the sessions. This time he decided to get off the elevator and enter the scene. To explore it and find out what there was about it that bothered him. He had already learned that if he was not comfortable with something he saw, that I allowed him the option to retreat. This gave him a feeling of security even in such an alien environment. Thus he allowed himself to step into the scene and was immediately overcome by a feeling of great sadness. He described what he saw. After several weeks, p. It's windy. Sandy and dusty. I feel it and see it. The sky is some, what reddish-orange tinted. I'm standing outside a spacecraft bay's a clearing where we landed. I'm looking at the spire. It's to my right. I had thought from his first description of this scene that it did not sound like any place on Earth. It had a definite otherworldly flavor to it. Now with his mention of the spacecraft I was certain that he was seeing a past life when he lived away from Earth. At last it appeared I would get my wish to explore other worlds. 9, 10, the keepers of the garden. The spire apparently was the strange monolith that he had described before. It stood out from the rest of the sharp peaks because of the odd-shaped, donut-like structure which surrounded the point. He continued with his description. P. There are some shacks or huts to the immediate right which were supply or storage areas. Sadly, which are now empty. D. Are there others with you? P. His voice had a somber tone. Only those on the ship. We're here to resupply and to check on the welfare of the scientists on this planet. They're colonists from the planet we're from. Our regular routes are on established trade routes. This is off the beaten path, so to say, in an isolated part of this galaxy. This is an isolated testing, mining and scientific colony here for scientific purposes only and not mainly for colonization. D. Do you know how long they've been on this planet? P. Time doesn't correlate to Earth years, but it has been 7 chronometers, although I can't explain what chronometers are. They have been colonizing and testing for 7. D. Is that a long period of time? P. For being on a planet, yes. D. Has it been a while since you have been to this planet to resupply? P. We come approximately every 2 chronometers. D. Did these people volunteer to do this work? P. Yes, all the work is voluntary. There is no conscription. Although I was interested in obtaining the story and finding out the reason for Phil's sadness, my curiosity took over and I asked for a physical description of the people on the ship. He said they were small in stature with large bald heads, light-skinned and not very muscular. D. Are they physically like humans with a circulatory system, or are they different? P. They are similar, yes. They have 2 arms and 2 legs, and eyes and ears and a mouth, but they have no nose. There is no need for a nose. This was part of the evolution. The mouth is but a mere slit and its only purpose is for drawing air. There is no tongue or vocal cords for speaking because the entire process of communication is telepathic. The Lost Colony, 2. The physical description sounded a little revolting but it did not seem to bother Phil to look at them. He said later he felt very comfortable with these alien beings. D. P. D. P. Do these people eat food? Yes. It is inserted into the slit of these people male and female. We are androgynous, all are who are of this race. At the time I knew vaguely what the word meant. I wasn't exactly sure whether it meant a being which had both sexes such as a hermaphrodite, or one having no definable sex. Obviously it meant a creature that reproduced by some other method than the one we are familiar with. P. We're more of a combined or a combination of both sexes in one, which is a blend of both male and female characteristics. D. I'm curious about that. How would androgynous people reproduce? Or do they live longer periods of time and have no need for reproduction? P. There is a longer lifespan, however. It is not permanent, so there is the need to procreate. There are roles which are played. The divisions, however, are not nearly as pronounced as what we are used to here on Earth. My curiosity being temporarily satisfied, I returned to the story. D. You say D. You have come to this planet to bring supplies to these scientists? Where are the scientists? P. Sadly, all except one are buried in the ground. There were a total of 12 who are all now. Except for the one, buried. The last survivor took the duty of burying the others. It was a shared responsibility until the last and his remains lie with the others. Only it is on top of the ground. D. Do you know what happened to these people? P. Yes, the monolith, the spire contained the telepathic records of what occurred here. They died of starvation and thirst, or its equivalent. A very slow and painful death. Was this the reason for his former reluctance to look at and re-experience this scene? It seemed to be painful for him to speak of. 12. The keepers of the garden, it. I gave suggestions that it would not bother him to think about it and discuss it. I told him it is often very helpful to get these memories out. D. Did these scientists have any way of growing food of their own? P. There was nothing on the planet to support natural growth. Imagine, if you will, a garden in the desert southwest. It would be the same. The rocks and the land are barren, as barren as any you can imagine on this planet Earth. The area was full of minerals, however, and it was for this purpose that the scientists were there. They were miners. D, you said thirst or the equivalent. In other words, there weren't any fluids or liquids either? P, that is correct. Everything ran out. It would never have happened if we had come on time.